Welcome to Radio Book Club on Radio Free Palmer 89.5. I'm Judy Getty, and I will be hosting the show today as we discuss The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. My guests are David Cheesham from Fireside Books and Nick Holum, a John Steinbeck fan. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So, David, I picked The Grapes of Wrath as it's listed as one of the many books that have been banned, and we are celebrating, I guess we could say, Banned Book Week. So will you give us a little background as to why we have a Banned Books Week?
Oh, my gosh. Why do we have banned books week? Why do we have banned books? Foundation of this country is that First Amendment that opens up the marketplace of ideas. And in schools and our libraries are places to practice that responsibility and freedom of speech, and to engage in a range of ideas and concepts and art. And that is troubling. For many people, that sounds okay on the abstract, but not okay on the specifics. And there are books that are typically challenged in libraries and in schools. They are often surprisingly good. Sometimes it's the best literature out there. It's not always the best literature out there that's challenged, but sometimes it is. And this is an example. And Sherman Alexis, who's written so many great books, is often challenged. And Ellen Hopkins, people who are writing thoughtful, profound, but sometimes troubling stuff will upset someone and a few people. It usually isn't a majority, but a few people will get excited and they'll show up at the school board meetings and the book will either be pulled or not pulled, but a lot of stirring gets done and lots of emotion and excitement, and it usually helps me sell more books.
Well, so there's an upside to it.
Well, yes, but I would rather sell books the right way.
And I think that, you know, the part where there will be some theme or concept in a book that is troubling to a reader, maybe has not even read the book, but has heard about something that's in the book. Right. And so because of that, wants the book to be, you know, banned or taken out of the school or that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And even at the university level now, they're, you know, kind of encouraging that so that they have these difficult conversations. They will pick a book in order to have difficult conversations.
And that's what education should be about, isn't it? It's having the conversations, looking at lives like this one, the Grapes of Wrath, looking at lives that are different in time and class and place and than the lives of many of the readers, that's essential for creating culture, for creating a conversation, for creating unity. And it doesn't mean you agree with everything, but it helps you to empathize with other points of view, other people, other lives, other ways of speaking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we'll get started then in looking at The Grapes of Wrath. But before we do, I want to remind listeners that you may call in during the live broadcast, which is on Wednesday from noon to 1, and share your thoughts with us. The number is 745-8900. So there's many ways that we can talk about this classic, and in some ways it was kind of intimidating to even pick something that's probably been talked about so much, and as I was saying, by smarter people than me. But I thought we would look at it the way that the person who wrote the introduction in my edition was Robert DeMott, and he broke it down as telling the story in different levels. And so the first level is the story of the Joad family. The second's the story of the migrants that move into California. The third level's the story of the United States and what's happening in the country at that time. And then the final level deals with, and this is DeMott's quote, commitment to our fellow man and the earth. So let's start with the story of the Joad family. Nick, do you want to just give us a brief kind of what is this book about?
Sure. It takes place during the Great Depression and tells the story of the Joad family, a family of poor tenant farmers who are tractored off their land and forced to follow opportunity west to California. The book begins with Tom Joad walking home from being in prison for 4 years and comes upon his childhood home with the window smashed in and the corner taken out by a tractor. Along the way, he meets Jim Casey, a former preacher who's sort of in a struggle with himself over, you know, his life and the meaning of his life and religion. And they meet Muley Graves, who is a sort of guy who refuses to leave the land. And Muley tells him that his family's over at his uncle's house, and so he finds the family there packing up the truck, and they head out to California, and as they get closer, they begin to hear sort of ominous stories about how the labor markets are going in California. They discover that the stories are true and that there's this oversupply of labor, there's jobs are scarce, fruit farmers have this power over people to set wages pretty much as low as they want. And so they arrive at this dilapidated sort of Hooverville is what they call it. And after a heated discussion with police, Jim Casey punches one of the police officers and is taken off to jail. So they lose track of Jim Casey, and the family leaves under threat of the tent city being burned down. They catch wind of a government camp, and they're treated with hospitality for a short while until they find out that landowners there are trying to plan to stage a riot and get it shut down. They lose track of they run out of work and are forced to leave the camp, and unwittingly they become scabs at another camp. Tom Joad becomes interested in this picket that's going on outside the camp and walks out to investigate it and finds that the picket's being led by none other than Jim Casey. After being released from prison, Jim Casey has become a sort of unionizer, trying to unionize the laborers. And, of course, he made a lot of enemies in the process, and the police hunt down Jim Casey and kill him in Tom's presence. Tom retaliates and is forced to go into hiding, and the family moves into a boxcar, and they sort of live in desperate conditions through the remainder of the novel.
A lot going on, yeah. So as you're telling that, you know, it sounds pretty, like, despondent. And so we can talk about how I think in the book there's hope, and then there's the dashing of that hope. And you know, I certainly think that is a theme that is present. So let's just examine some of these characters that make up the family. So Tom Joad, as you said, Nick, had just gotten out of prison. So, you know, what kind of man is Steinbeck trying to portray Tom Joad as?
Well, I don't think it's a criminal, really. He sort of acted out of desperation in the way this situation was reasonable. It wasn't that he was attacked by another man at a party in Herb, and the guy had a knife in him, and he'd do the only thing that anyone else would have done, which is to fight back. And I think that sort of reflects the whole mentality that the people have, the migrants.
So it is portrayed as a self-defense. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, but he still ends up doing, I think, 4 years in McAllister, the local prison. So, and, you know, so that comes up frequently then throughout the novel because Tom has to break parole in order to leave Oklahoma and go to California. And so the family's constantly operating under the fear of what if Tom gets caught. And so as you said earlier, part of the plot where he does get involved in another situation, ends up hitting a man in a fight where Jim Casey is killed, he's hiding out of fear both of going back to jail and of having broken his parole. But certainly very committed to his family. Right. And I think that, again, is another theme that we'll talk about with this the characters in this book. So one of Tom's brothers is Al, a younger brother, and I think in the book they say he's 16.
Yeah, yeah.
So Al is kind of a randy young fellow. He likes to always look for girls wherever he's at, and oftentimes the family's wondering where he is, but he's out looking for a good time. But he's also very capable. He's the one who fixes the truck, keeps it running, and it seems to help shepherd the family around. Plus, being so young, he's obviously a hard worker. David, you were going to say something?
Just the very sort of the practical part of the family, be able to fix things.
That's very helpful.
Well, and he's been saddled with a lot of responsibility, and I think he's kind of the whole book, during the part where his main responsibility is, you know, keeping that car running to get across to California, he's sort of looking to Tom for approval.
So one of the other brothers is Noah. And Noah's kind of an odd character. I think the critical thing about him is that when he was their firstborn. He's Mom, Pa, Jode's first son, first child. And so when he's being born, Pa's there to help Ma deliver Noah. And in doing so, is so over-anxious in helping the baby be born that he grabs him out, and then ever after, Noah is kind of different.
Right.
And so he doesn't always fit in. So Noah, as the family's heading across country and the family gets to Needles, California, Noah just decides to stay in Needles. He wanders off down the river. And so it's like,
get a piece of fishing line. And yeah. A man can... if you can't live by a river, you can't live anywhere, is what he says.
Right.
That's right.
So, and this is another theme in the book, kind of the disintegration of the family and how family members drop off and away. So, you know, we'll be talking about that too. Ma Jode.
Her and Tom Jode are the pretty much the central characters of the book. You know, that relationship is always in the main focus. Their conversations are usually the ones you remember the most. But I think she's really the head of the family and sort of takes over the family, even though I felt like even though there's that taking over the family that happens later in the book where she sort of I feel like even before then she's definitely the head of the family.
She's certainly a force. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I mean, from the very beginning, before you even meet her, there's a sense, and I wanted to ask you about this, about the women in the book. There's a the very first scene. There's a generic, without characters. It was the men, realizing that the drought was going to hit them and realizing what that was going to happen. And then behind them, the women were watching the men for an expression that it was okay to visit. And that there was an intuition that they were struggling with this. And I don't know if it was a threat of violence or if it was a threat of just shouting and screaming or just a threat of they're not ready to talk or whatever, but there's just a silence there waiting for that. And there was a, and then Ma Jode has, you know, in the first meeting, there's a strength that she has. She doesn't, if I remember right, she doesn't really embrace when she meets, when she sees that Tom Joad. There's this great scene where Tom Joad is out in the sun, so she can't tell who it is, and she says, come on in, you can have breakfast, we have plenty for you, and then he comes in and she realizes who it is, but she goes to him quickly, but with control, and I think it was just a touch, it wasn't a big hug, tearful hug, it was a very, there's this kind of rich strength that she had, I think Steinbeck is saying something about the strength of the Western woman in this time and in the rural areas. I thought it was really powerful.
I'm going to comment on that, but I just want to remind listeners that they're listening to Radio Book Club on 89.5, and if they want to call in and share their thoughts, they can do so at 745-8900. So in my edition, the person who wrote the introductions talks about how Steinbeck's female characters, and I don't know if they meant in general or just this book, tended to be, I'll say weak, but I don't think that was the word he used, but just that they were not major characters. And so I guess I had my hackles up a little bit. And so when I was reading it, I thought, is this true? And as I was reading the Ma character, I just thought she was extremely powerful. Right. I thought there was moments when she did show real strength. And like you said, Nick, that, later on they really point out, and it's page 423 of my edition. So, it's later on that they say Ma's taken over the family, that Pa has just kind of said, I'm not making decisions anymore. It's obvious that Ma is doing that. But there was many indications along the way. Another one was when they come across some people and they're helping them, the Wilsons. And so the Wilson's car needs some repairs, and so there's this discussion about some people will stay behind and help them do that, and the rest of them will go on. And Ma is, like, absolutely refusing that they will be split up. No, we're not going to try to find each other further down the road. We're sticking together. And then as it turns out, they're able to, get the part they need and get it fixed up and keep everybody together. But she's just adamant in that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think another example is in the grocery store later on when she's trying to spend her $10 and they're at a company store.
Right.
I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit. You remember that scene?
Yeah, I do remember that scene. I remember one really specific line in the scene where Ma turns around and after talking to this guy about getting some meat, and we need some meat. She's only got like a couple cents, She bought an overpriced loaf, everything at the company store is overpriced. So first you get to you start working and they cut your wages, and then you can't go into town to buy groceries. So you go to the company store and prices are way higher than they should be. But anyway, she's arguing with this man about getting a piece of meat, and finally the man, gives in and gives it to her on credit, even though he's not supposed to. And she says, you can't. If you want something, you should ask a poor person for it, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is memorable.
Yes.
And it really is, again, how these families operate. And right. We can move into talking about just the migrants as a group. And I think that's one of the first things that you're struck with is just how helpful they are to each other all along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're all poor and struggling.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other interesting things about the structure of this book, though, is that Steinbeck alternates the chapters. And so, David, earlier you were referring to a chapter that was talking about the women watching the men. Those chapters are not about the Joad family or their travel across the country. Those chapters are kind of the bigger picture and are giving the reader a chance to really understand what the country was grappling with and what this movement of people were facing as they were going across the land, but also what they had lost. And one of the things that I had marked here, pull it up here pretty quick, was Sure, cried the tenant men, but it's our land. We measured it and broke it up. We were born on it. We got killed on it, died on it. Even if it's no good, it's still ours. That's what makes it ours, being born on it, working it, dying on it. That makes ownership, not a paper with numbers on it. And what's happening here is that these, the monster that they're referring to are the banks or these companies that are taking over the land. So this idea that it's not these poor, impoverished farmers who have worked the land for so many years that are going to lose, you know, that are losing their land to another person, they're losing it to this monster, which is a company or a bank or a land holding or something other than a human being.
Right, without the moral responsibility.
Yeah.
So, and I think one of the notes I made about that kind of idea, too, is that, yes, yeah, so if, you know, I thought companies and people are the same thing, right? So, you know, but then by facing, you know, a company, not a human being, and so when these human beings would show up and tractor over the land, like Nick said earlier, you know, take away the land from the tenant farmers, they say, hey, I'm just kind of doing a job. It's not me. It's, you know, some other entity.
Yeah, someone you can't shoot.
Yeah,
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 someone
exactly.
You can't shoot. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
So earlier, Nick, you also mentioned this character, Muley. Mm-hmm. So he is a contrast to all of these tenant farmers who are giving up, we'll say, giving up their land, which must have been incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Muley decides to stay, and he's kind of living, you know, running from place to place, staying, and he's kind of got all the tricks of the company men down. He knows where to hide in the weeds, and that's one of the scenes that I'm thinking of is when Tom and Jim Casey are walking back to the house, and they're just going through the stuff, and Muley comes up, and they all share some rabbits. Muley's kind of living just like a coyote. He's got rabbits, and he's trapping, So they all share this meal, and then they see some lights flickering up, and Muley knows what's going on. He's been through this before. They're trying to, you know, push Muley off the land, and they go out and hide in the weeds. And Muley says, "Should I take a shot at him?" And Jim Casey says, "No, I don't think that would really do anything. You know, we need a better fix than that."
Right. Yes. So he and his family left. He stayed behind because he's so attached to the land. And even though he's going to have to live in hiding, basically, and live off the land that way, he wouldn't leave it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to imagine that there are probably other individuals who felt the same way. And so there's, you know, the separation of family, and Steinbeck does talk about that in the novel, that, you know, maybe not necessarily a husband who stayed behind, but certainly if part of the family left, they may have left elderly parents behind, or they might have left, you know, other family members behind. And so where people tended to be born and stay in the same area and always have those family kind of contacts, that's going to be lost now. Mm-hmm. They're not going to have that anymore.
Right. And I think he's interesting as a contrast. I mean, because the theme of the book is about being together and working together, the union, the family, all of these institutions that are working together, and he is basically a hermit. You know, he's having to hide and deal with it all by himself. So it's
right. Mm-hmm. Just he cannot make that disconnect, I think, from place.
Right.
One of the other quotes I like, and this goes to, you know, in thinking again about, you know, I think in our modern world, we all have so much stuff. And so if we even imagine, okay, we're packing up, we're moving, and all we've got is this truck, and there's going to be 12 people on it and our stuff, you know, what can you take? And so even though these people lived much more minimalist than we would ever consider living, they are going through their lives. They're going through the stuff of their lives. And so at one point, and this is another quote, it says, "How can we live without our lives? How will we know it's us without our past? No, leave it, burn it." And so as they're deciding what they will take and what they'll leave behind, they're kind of just piling things up and burning it so that it's destroyed. So a lot of their history, a lot of how they define who they are is gone.
Yeah, and in a way, they, I mean, they're going on this new start and they have all these ideas of how it's going to be better, and it's really not. Along the way, you know, those sort of, as they're traveling, those sort of ominous, it's like two times where they're told how the labor markets are, and they kind of choose to refuse to believe that because they're in denial and they really have no other option but to go. I mean, they're tractored out.
As I was reading this book, another book I was reading was by a psychologist who's done research on optimism. And so I thought, well, this is fitting because it kind of fits that. So as human beings, we tend to hear bad news, or if there's bad news kind of in a global sense, we think that applies to others, and we don't necessarily believe it'll be true for us. And I thought that is, you know, I don't think Steinbeck, you know, saw any of this research because it's recent. But that is so true of the Joad family. It was sort of like they would hear, you know, it's bad out there. The wages are poor. And if you're getting 20 cents, they'll lower it to 15 because there's 200 people that want your, you know, that job. And so it's grim. And so there was people that were in California that were leaving California because it just wasn't working. And the Joads just push on, and maybe not with the same level of hope, but certainly with the belief that they can make it.
Right.
I mean, would you say that as they push on, they're still thinking, oh, we'll do fine?
I think they're trying to convince themselves of that.
Right.
We'll get a little house. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they're, you know, they really, to maybe an extreme kind of point, and then it becomes, well, we'll just have enough to eat.
And then, well, and they were doing fine sort of at that government camp. They were, you're like, oh, things are kind of looking up. Tom's got a job, and they got hot showers.
And the most critical thing there was that we were being treated as human beings.
Yeah.
Is how they felt.
Yeah.
Right.
So say a little bit about how authority is portrayed in the novel. So like police authority or the government authority versus the government authority, maybe?
Well, they just kind of become the rich man's lackeys, sort of. They do, well, the landowner's bidding, and they usually only enforce the law if it's in favor of the landowner. So it's just kind of an unfortunate situation that they're pretty much owned.
Mm-hmm. And, so it didn't necessarily matter where they came from. They were all called Okies. Mm-hmm. And that was not a term of endearment.
Right.
So an Okie, and it was even specifically, they compared them to gorillas. And so, again, you know, we think in terms of, you know, and this is part of our history, too, that at any given point, we kind of designate the group that's going to be hated, the group that we see as other. And so at this particular period of time, the migrants from the middle America moving to California were all called Okies, and they were seen as less than.
Right. And then put in a position where they couldn't become more. And so it was a catch-22 for them.
Right.
Yeah.
And it, right, so it was self-fulfilling, not necessarily self-fulfilling, but it fulfilled the outsider's point of making them seem less than true. Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the other things that I was noting that, you know, here are these people who now have left their farms that they've had in their families for generations and feel really tied to the land. And you know, so these aren't people who said, okay, it's not working here on the farm, let's go into town and try to get a job. They're going to look for more work in the agricultural industry. And so as they're going, you know, into California, and they see fallow fields. So they see large areas of land that are not being worked. And they, you know, and it's almost like, you know, an alcoholic who's walking by a bottle shop. So they're like, oh, if I just had an acre, you know, if I just had an acre of this land, you know, Ma could plant and have enough food. And so it's almost a shameful kind of situation from their point of view, that here's all this rich land that's not being used to grow food.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And very, very sad. And that whole thing about consolidation of the farms, you know, one of the causes of you know, the instigators of the story, one is the weather, but the other is this move towards larger farms, tractor farming, that were the, you know, it was easier for big companies to farm many, many acres of land and consume or collect all of these into one farm and consolidate this, and become, things are becoming less individual, less human, and more machine-like, and there's a sense of forces like the weather that are beyond their control.
We're at the bottom of the hour, so I just want to let our listeners know that you are tuned in to Radio Free Palmer 89.5. That's Big Cabbage Radio. And we're talking about The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck on Radio Book Club. So, as, you know, part of the buildup, I think, in the novel, too, is about the discontent that, you know, the people are starting to see, the migrants are starting to see that this isn't going to work. You know, what we thought we could do is come out here and earn a livable wage, have a new start and survive and maybe even advance, but it's not going to work. And so Steinbeck talks about, you know, the anger fermenting. And Casey talks about people being bad out of need, because when he was in jail, he met several other people who'd be arrested. And so here's these decent, hardworking people that are forced to start stealing food, forced to start to engaging in behaviors that they would not otherwise do out of desperation. And so, you know, part of their organizing then is out of the need to survive.
Mm-hmm. Similar to what Tom Joe does right in the beginning of the book, or what he's getting off of doing or serving time for. Yeah. In self-defense. It's really just about survival. And
And Tom makes some references about back in jail, and, you know, at least he had a meal, and, you know, he had some work, and he knew where he was going to sleep. In some ways, jail was better.
Yeah, right. There's that one character, or the other guy that he met in jail that got out and committed a crime right away just so he could go back in. Mm-hmm. Just because he's like, well, my dad doesn't have any work anymore. And it's better. I got 3 hot meals a day.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, do you remember that story, these little side stories about a family left, I forget what they left for, and everyone else just assumed they had left for good, and everyone came, and then they just sort of, you know, we would call it looting. They went in and they took everything from the house. They wouldn't think of it as stealing. It's just the family left. And so, and then the family came back and they said, oh, I'm sorry. And he was able to get back most of everything that they had taken. I just love that little vignette. And it's, you know, there was a morality, a basic morality there that didn't fit into, you know, thou shalt not steal. It was still a respect for the person's rights. And that was tested and carried forth. And
Earlier when you're talking about the small farms being taken over by larger, I mean, that was still happening up and through the 50s, 60s, 70s, even. I grew up in the Midwest. And that, you know, it was true. People would just walk away from their houses and they would leave things in there. So, you know, the scene where they're burning things, some people would just walk away. And so there would be furniture in there. There'd be personal belongings. Sometimes we'd say it looks like they just had breakfast and got up and left from the table. So we would drive around out in the country and look for those old farmhouses that had people just walked away from.
It's amazing.
Yes, it is incredible. So when I was talking about the organizing, they're up against this huge, I don't know, mindset, I guess, because the people are so involved in survival and trying to feed their starving children that to try to get those people to say, no, I won't even work for a nickel, because at least they feel like, okay, now I'm working and I can get some food. But in some level, they know they can't feed their family on a nickel. And so to try to get them all to band together and say, okay, we're not going to work, and so that, you know, that they would picket these farms and say, nobody's going to work unless you pay, you know, X amount. And the incredible hurdle that had to have been.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's kind of like what Karl Marx, or I mean, John Steinbeck is accused of attacking capitalism with this book, and, or being a red, which is the same thing as Jim Casey's accused of right before he dies, but that's one of the things that Karl Marx said was how capitalism is going to work is people are, you know, there's going to be an accumulation of wealth, and these people are just going to have so much power and wealth that there's going to be what he called the army of the unemployed. So you got these guys who, it doesn't matter if you can just fire them and keep cycling them through, and there's nothing you can really do to fight it. And of course you can unionize, but that's hard. Easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, because they would, part of what the novel says is they would take anybody who looked like they were taking a leadership role and immediately put them in jail. So anybody who would step forward and try to organize these masses of people and get them to agree to not work for the small wages, yeah, they were immediately taken out. But you did a nice segue there to the next level of the book, which is talking about what's going on in the United States at the time. And so I'm going to read this quote. Some of the owner men were kind because they hated what they had to do, and some of them were angry because they hated to be cruel, and some of them were cold because they had long ago found that one could not be an owner unless one were cold. And all of them were caught in something larger than themselves. And I thought, you know, Steinbeck is making such a great point about, you know, on one level we could say that these were just evil, greedy people who wanted to acquire as much wealth as possible on the backs of the poor people. But Steinbeck, I think, is being a little more sympathetic here, that these were decent people too. But then in order to kind of get ahead or do well for themselves, again, practicing some self-interest, they recognized what they were becoming. And they hated it, and they were angry because they felt that that's what they had to become in order to acquire.
Well, in a way, yeah, that's what kind of happened. I mean, during World War I, everyone was, you know, all the farmers are getting used to all these big profits they're making because all the other farmland in other countries is tied up, and so they're producing a lot and they're making a lot of money. Well, once the Great Depression came along, they started losing money, and of course, you're running a business, you're trying to keep your profit, and so that's sort of the struggle, the thing that they struggled with the most was you're trying to keep your profit and run your business and do the right thing, and at the same time you're seeing these people who are being treated inhumanely and out of sight, out of mind. If you can keep, just, you know, keep yourself as far away from it as you can. And I think that's what most of them try to do.
Mm-hmm. We kind of alluded to this a little bit about what, you know, now you're saying after World War I, yes, the profits were high. You know, we had these tenant farmers. People were making a decent living. And then partly in, you know, maybe in their greed or in their desire to advance themselves, more land was being plowed up. And, you know, historically, when we look at the causes of the Dust Bowl, it's now seen that it was, you know, man-made, and that they plowed up the grasslands that really, you know, the grass was there to hold the dirt in place. And so they plow it up, and then in the early 30s, we had these incredible dust storms where, you know, people could not go out in it, and people actually died from dust-related illnesses. And so, you know, that was also a factor in what was happening in the country.
Wiped out all the topsoil.
Yes, yeah, just, yes.
Yeah.
It went to other places. And then, you know, we're kind of talking about, you know, two classes of people here, kind of the tenant farmers and then let's say the big landholders or people who are getting wealthy. But then there's all the kind of peripheral people who can take advantage then. So in one chapter, he talks about the people who sell used cars.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of, again, the same story we hear today, that if you think about as a class of people, and I'm going to generalize here because of certainly, you know, we all know nice used car salespeople, but that they're kind of slimy and sleazy and...
Right.
These, yeah, putting sawdust in the muffler to quiet it down a little bit.
Yeah, they had all kinds of tricks to try to get rid of these vehicles. They would put near bald tires on there and then try to sell additional tires and just anything to, you park, know, again, make a buck. Yeah.
Park it so the patch was on the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And along with that, when the people had to leave their farms, they had to sell their property. And so they would take all of, you know, the belongings that they weren't going to burn or take with them into town to unload. And so then there was people, that was their enterprise, to buy up what the farm families were getting rid of. And, of course, they got next to nothing for it, even if they could turn around and sell it for much more. So, again, all, you know, all these people that are kind of on the periphery of you know, making money off of people who really had were at a loss. So, Nick, you said something about, you know, what, you know, we're talking about this as a banned book. So why is this a banned book? So I was going to read this quote, and this is something that Casey says because he's certainly the one who, you know, would have been thought of as the red. I got thinking how we was holy when we was one thing, and mankind was holy when it was one thing, and it only got unholy when one miserable little fella got the bit in his teeth and run off his own way, kicking and dragging and fighting. Fella like that busts the holiness. But when they are all working together, not one fella for another fella, but one fella kind of harnessed to the whole shebang, that's right, that's holy. And then I got thinking, I don't even know what I mean by holy. So when he's talking about one versus the many, I mean, what do you think, David? What is he getting at?
Well, you know, and that's why the other character who's basically living as a character, as a hermit, is so interesting to me, because that is, you know, I think it's an interesting passage because he's out there alone thinking it. And the epiphany comes with him, to him by himself. But that something happens when your life is more more than yourself that makes it holy. If it's more than just you and involved, and when you are somehow your purpose is tied to a greater good, which is in this case, greater good for humanity and other people. I think it it is challenging and it's subversive, but there's a lot to think about. There's a lot to chew on.
So what part of it do you think, and, you know, the note I made by it was, you know, socialism, question mark. So what part of this why is this something that people in the United States, let's just say that's pretty large, but would not want to hear? Why would that be a challenge to our form of government or how we see?
Well, you know, the I don't know if it's socialism is as much as unionism, but the and in the history of unions, there's a swath that was definitely socialist, but there's also one that. Said the union reforms were going to save capitalism from socialism, but there are people out there who feel like it's all of one or the other, and if you are if you want any kind of anything, if you want anything, you know, there are people who believe that if you do anything that will alleviate poverty or give people some empowerment in their lives, then you're a socialist, and that there's only two ways to go, and one is you know, Stalinism, and the other is laissez-faire capitalism, and this I think when in the whole, that's why I keep coming back to the individualism that is also in the book. This is a whole trying to find a balance between those poles. and a balance that's works for people who are earthy and real and whose struggles are real. And
I think about the maxim that many of us live by, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Right.
And so oftentimes when I'm teaching classes, I'll have students talk about that. You know, do you believe you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps? And I think, you know, maybe in our culture that pertains to us more so than people in other cultures, that we believe this individual sense of effort. We get to where we are by our efforts.
Right.
And a little bit of what he's talking about here, which is absolutely true. I mean, we have to have some efforts, right?
Yeah.
There's our talents, our abilities, our skills, mm-hmm. and then our efforts. But what about the external? What about what's external to us, the others that make it holy? So, you know, getting opportunities or making connections or people opening doors for us. And so all of that is the other piece of it.
Oh, yeah. And my family, my dad grew up in a dirt floor, actually, I think in Oklahoma. He was he traveled around a lot. So he did well by himself, for himself, and for us. But the thing is, he didn't do it all by himself. He was in construction in Florida, and he was successful because he was able to take advantage, or his customers were able to take advantage of government loans that were suddenly available in the 50s and 60s. For housing that made it easier for people to buy houses, and it made it easier for him to build and sell houses. And so there's a mixture, and you know, no one would deny that he had a lot of initiative and hard work, but to cling to this fantasy that people do it by themselves. I did this all by myself.
Self-made man.
It wasn't always easy, but I think he did admit to himself that he had some help.
So you are listening to Radio Book Club on 89.5. We're talking about banned books, specifically The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. If you'd like to call in and rant with us, you're more than welcome to do that. So typically when I read a book, I will oftentimes miss, you know, the metaphor. But this one struck me. So early on in the book, the family's, you know, making this trip, and they've stopped at a gas station. And again, one of the things they had packed initially was their dog. The dog was going with them on the trip. And so when they stop and the dog's out running around, the dog never lived near a highway. And so now the dog is running around in this Lincoln Zephyr, which must have been a pretty high class, expensive car, runs over the dog. And I thought, you know, is this something then that says this is what the rich are doing to the poor migrants?
Yeah.
Can I read that much into it? Because sometimes I miss those sort of things.
Well, you know, there are several. I remember that one. Well, that one and one other. And I know I can't pinpoint the third one, there are several things about contact between human and animals, and. The first, I remember when reading about Tom Joad and the turtle, thinking, oh no, this is not going to go well, because the turtle has just made it over someone veers off and tries to hit the turtle and knocks the turtle off the road, but he survives. And I'm thinking, what's Todd Joad going to do when he picks up the turtle? Because I didn't know the character at that point. And he picks him up and he saves him, and he wants to give him to his brother. And so it seems like the people in power are the ones who express that towards animals. They're the way they act towards animals is the way they act towards other people. And I think Steinbeck probably did that at some level. He was conscious of that at some level.
Again, I think, you know, as you were talking about that, that mixture of hope, despair, that was constantly
encapsulate the whole. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, one of the other quotes in here, and talking about, you know, that these people, they say, we're the people. We go on. And which I think just really points out that it doesn't matter what hardships we face, we will go on.
Right.
And, you know, there, you notice that it is the plural. And when I was watching the Dust Bowl Ken Burns documentary, and he said that they referred to themselves as tomorrow people. Is that right? That it'll be better tomorrow or next year, next year people. That next year it would be better. The crop would be better. The weather would be better. They'd get more rain. So next year would be better.
Right.
So again, back to that, you know, that optimism, kind of the eternal optimists. They're always looking to the future.
And in hindsight, you know, were they right? I guess, you know, over the that generation grew up and after the war and the 50s and especially the 60s were the time of prosperity for the country and the time where in our history the most or the least amount of inequality between the very rich and the very poor during that time. So something right happened in that short window when up, you know, after the war and up through the, I guess, some of the 70s. And
So what is the message in that, though? I mean, because I think about some of my family who their struggles included that kind of effort to stay on the land and farm the land and make a living and large families and keep everybody together and at the same time thinking, I want it easier for my children. And so, you know, I think we've kind of passed that down where, you know, the struggles of our ancestors were such that it would be easier for the generations to come. But at the same time, you know, you'll hear some people in the older generation say, now we've made it too easy for the young people. They don't think they have to work and they think that, you know, things should just be handed to them. And so, you know, so do we want everybody to struggle? Is that is that what we're saying? Nick, you can answer this.
I think you can gain a lot from struggling. I think you can learn a lot from, you'll learn a lot more from struggling than not. If you have things handed to you your whole life, you're probably just going to expect that. And
right.
Generation after generation kind of looks at the next generation that way, though, or has been in the past few decades, where all these guys have it so easy. If they were in my day, they wouldn't have made it. But
Well, and struggle is one of those terms that, I mean, it can apply in a number of different ways. And certainly with the Jode family and the migrants, they were struggling with some real basic things, just surviving, getting enough food and you know, taking care of each other. So, I mean, struggles can be on different levels.
Yeah.
So. Right. Well, it has a lot to do with whether there really is hope. And I mean, going back to that Langston Hughes poem about hope deferred, and there's a very real difference between a context where hard work and struggle where there's light at the end of the tunnel and where there's frustration at every turn. And I hope that what we have for the future is more like that, more with real opportunity and real quality of life possibilities for people.
Spoiler alert, because I'm going to say one of the things that happens at the end of the book. But we didn't talk about Rose of Sharon, who is Tom Jode's sister. Yeah. And in the book, she's married. And at one point, Connie runs off her husband, which, you know, is pretty despicable. You know, she's pregnant and he just runs off. And, of course, she's very worried. And she's not very capable of working or helping out much because of her condition. So at the end of the book, it's time now for her to, you know, have the baby. She goes into labor. And so Ma Jode and one of the other women who's living in the boxcar at the cotton camp are helping her to deliver the baby. And the baby does not survive. And so they put it in a bag and they ask somebody to go bury it. And Uncle John, we haven't talked about Uncle John either, but Uncle John, who also has some kind of mental health issues because he did not help his wife at a time when she needed some medical intervention and she ends up dying.
Right.
So, but the baby dies. And so when a baby dies, I mean, that usually represents a loss of hope. I mean, the birth of a child usually represents, oh, you know, here's the next generation, we will carry on. And so I was thinking, I wonder, you know, what thought did Steinbeck give to having the infant die? What's the message to us if the infant doesn't survive?
Well, I know that you, in your notes, said that you put lots of hope, question mark.
Yeah.
And and I thought, yeah, at the same time, when they go to the barn, and they're in the barn, and this kid has been with his father, or it was his grandfather, and the grandfather's been giving him all this food and giving him all of his food, and finally he's just wasting away in this barn, and Rose and Sharon lost the child, you know, but they have nothing to give these people. They have nothing. They don't have any food, but she still has her breast milk and gives it to the man. Well, I thought that was really hopeful.
Okay.
I thought,
yeah.
Well, and again, you know, maybe part of the reason why this book was banned. I mean, mm-hmm. that's pretty revolutionary to right. include in a book mm-hmm. that was published in 1939, mm-hmm. you know, that image of her breastfeeding a dying old man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just such a desperate image, but it's like so, so real, and I don't know, it's...
So you felt that was hopeful.
I thought that was really hopeful.
Okay. there is hope for humankind yet.
Right.
Yeah, they really have come down to nothing. So the fourth level, and we just have a couple minutes left, but I just wanted to make sure that we talk about, and that was a nice segue for that too, because that is that commitment to our fellow man and the earth. And, you know, at one point, Steinbeck is talking about that the people are questioning that somehow they've done something, that they've sinned and caused the land problems. And I thought that was such an interesting idea that, you know, that the people back on the family farms thought, well, we must have done something to brought this on ourselves. So I don't know if either of you want to comment on this idea that we bring our troubles on ourselves. Nope.
No comment, no.
We just do, don't right, we?
Yeah. I feel like, yeah, things just happen sometimes.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, hope and despair. So what ultimate kinds of messages do you think Steinbeck is giving us about humanity and I guess self-interest versus how do we help each other?
Well, I found that going back to the guy who Tom gets his first job from as they're in the government camp, and that guy is sort of... I don't know. I feel like there were probably a good amount of people like him who are both landowners, but they're part of this association that wants to keep the wages at a certain level. But they have this empathy for the people, and I felt that was sort of the struggle that a lot of people were in, being that they were part of the system that they're in, and they want to do something, but they feel completely powerless. And I think that is kind of what everyone kind of feels like in a lot of instances. Like, I could feel bad for people making iPods in China, and I feel like that there's nothing I can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So, but do you think, though, that he's also saying that, so we have to look at, well, what can I do?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and so that it comes down to what is mm-hmm. an individual action?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and I think, again, because it comes up so oftentimes throughout the book, you know, and what can I do for others?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so that it's not just about me, but how can I help the people who, you know, that I come into contact with?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which isn't true for everybody, because the one scene where they're destroying all the food as the hungry, starving people watch, you know, they throw all those pigs into, you know, this ditch and just burn them and the food. And they put all the potatoes in the water and won't let the poor people go in the water and get them. I mean, it's just – it's kind of a black mark, I think, on our history that people were treated that way.
Yeah.
So I want to thank – David and Nick for joining me today as we talked about The Grapes of Wrath on Radio Book Club for Banned Book Week, which is this week, September 21st to the 27th. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Next month, we'll be discussing The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón on October 29th. It is National Friends of Libraries Week from October 19th to the 25th, and so I wanted to honor the work that our libraries do. My guests will be Lauren Getty King and Katie Schweisthal from Palmer Library. I also want to remind listeners that Radio Free Palmer is a community station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading. Thank you.